to build a shopping mall. That's Occupy the Farm, Thursday, April 2nd, 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Listen to The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of each month at 11:30 a.m. The Film Show features news and interviews about the local and independent film scene. That's The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of the month at 11:30 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach, and welcome. My guest today is memoirist Alexandra Fuller. Born in Glossop, England in 1969, she grew up in Africa and is the author of three memoirs: Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, An African Childhood, and currently Leaving Before the Rains Come, just published by Penguin Press. Welcome back to Between the Covers, Alexandra.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, do you prefer Al or Bobo or Miss Bob or Miss Bobo? What's your favorite?
It's interesting. I think that's an absolute telltale sign that you come from Southern Africa if you stagger out of there with more names than you came into the world with.
Novelists have told me that successive novels require that they delve deeper to get a good result again. Is that true of writing memoirs?
Absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's absolutely beautifully put. I think deeper and sparer. You can't rely so much on experience, since more or less, you know, what's happened has happened. That kind of has unfolded. But I think, for me, every time that I sort of go back and look at my life, I feel as if there's a sloughing off of self. In other words, there's less me in every memoir.
I get it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you find that people are more revealing of who they are to you as you get older?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, certainly not my mother. She's terrified I'm going to put her in another awful book. So she's very careful what she says. Actually, that's not true. She's become even more badly behaved in some ways, because she'll say the most outrageous things and then sort of look at me out the corner of her eye to make sure I'm taking notes. And I don't think that people are more revealing to me. I think I'm better at noticing. I've become more observant and less noisy. And the quality of my listening has changed the older I've got. I mean, I'm at least halfway through my life, if not more at this point. And I think that we spend the first half, if you're anything like me anyway, sort of yelling your head off trying to be heard. And then if you're lucky enough to have found a voice, which is, I think, the luckiest thing that's ever happened to me, you can sit back and start to listen. And so, yeah, people do become more revealing, but not on purpose.
Do you have a place you consider to be your hometown?
No.
And is that difficult for you?
I mean, I don't know any different. I think that I remember at, yes, it has been difficult, but not now. I mean, it's something that I dealt with young, which was the horror of realizing that the place that I loved, really beyond the imagining of most people who live in this country, I think, didn't belong to me, that I belonged to a place, that for which I felt very little identity, which was UK. You know, when I was 18, my parents sort of dropped the bomb on me that I was not Zambian, I wasn't Zimbabwean, I had a British passport. I didn't feel even the tiniest bit British.
And yet you went to university in Canada. What was that like for you?
Well, you know, I think so. To begin with, the options were for me to go to university either in South Africa or, you know, overseas in Scotland. My mother's family were she had Scottish relatives, and the thing that's not very well understood is it's very nearly impossible to get into an African university because there are so few of them. You have to be beyond brilliant. And I most certainly was not beyond brilliant. So there was no hope I was going to be one of the lucky people to get into a university on the continent. And so my parents sent me overseas to Scotland, and I was so miserable. It just felt as if the world was closing in on me. And so without telling them, I got myself transferred to Canada.
Oh, really?
Well, at least that, you know, and oddly enough, my father had done the same thing. He had fled the UK for Canada. And I didn't realize that I was doing absolutely what he had done. And I wonder how much of we think we're in reaction to something in us, but really we're just stepping onto the path that was there all the time. And I loved Canada. I found it, you know, obviously very different from Zambia, but it was peaceful. It was a profoundly peaceful place back then. I mean, this was before their conservative government that's become as militaristic as the US, the current conservative government. But back then, it really, the relief of being in a country that had a maple leaf on its flag, you think, you know, how exceptional can they be? And there was something very gentle and very forgiving and very literary about the community. It was a rich literary history. I loved my university professors. They were warm. They weren't sort of standoffish like the Scots. They really cared about the fact that I wanted to write. And in fact, I'm still in touch with my poetry professor all these 26 years on.
What were some of the books that you read while you were there that profoundly influenced you?
Well, what was amazing was I took a course in Commonwealth literature and maybe for the first time was exposed to the Nigerian and Ghanaian writers, the Kenyan writers, and even the Zimbabwean writers, black writers, all of them, that I had not really even heard of. I mean, here was this wealth of literature. Chinua Achebe, of course, and Ben Okri, and Ngugi wa Thiong'o, and Dambadzo Marachera, Chenjerai Hovi. You know, I had a Bessie Head. I mean, I had not heard of that. It was as if somebody had cleaned the windows on my view of the continent, and I understood where I came from very differently as a result of that. Now, interestingly, I had read, you know, Southern African writers whom I would consider, you know, they were subversive enough to be in trouble with the governments at the time, Doris Lessing and Nadine Gordimer, J.M. Coetzee, but they were white, you know, and it made a difference. It made a difference realizing that there was a tapestry of voices.
And it had been there for a while, too.
Had been there for decades.
You know, your parents seemed to indicate that they preferred a proper impropriety in their lives.
I love that way of looking at it. Yeah, that seems right. I think that you know, I was very much struck when I you know, married a U.S. citizen and I moved to the States. And he was from mainline Philadelphia, he said, which I was so relieved. I thought, oh, thank God, there's people are heroin addicts. He'll fit right in with my boozy bunch. I didn't realize it was this going to be this puritanical streak. And there really are so many unbreachable rules in the sort of puritanical culture we have. And it feels strange to me because I think the 60s and 70s, it's sort of, you know, and I can only look at it sort of from an almost like an anthropologist. I didn't live it. But looking back, and maybe being the recipient of some of that sort of idea of freedom, you know, the sort of flower power and the hippie era and the, you know, the Grateful Dead and things that we would hear about in Zimbabwe. I think that was a real attempt to break through the calcification of a puritanical mind. But in fact, you know, I would argue that we're sort of almost back in another 50s now, another straitjacket of proper rules and sort of quote-unquote good behavior. And I come from such a wildly different background, which was that my parents, especially my father, really celebrated the person who could sail that fine line between being fun and free, but not vulgar.
Tom McGuane told me that dissent is the great American value. Do you see much of that today here?
I don't. What I see more of is a culture that is in lockstep unconsciously with being a black dot on somebody else's bottom line. We are so acculturated to a consumer culture that I think we are, most of us are blind to how much we're sort of jiggled about by, you know, the industrial military machines, so, you know, to sort of speak in terms that make you sound like a conspiracy theorist. But what I see is minority communities beginning to speak up and fight out. I think we saw that with Ferguson. I don't know how that was a surprise to the rest of the country. And we're seeing it in our Native American communities. And I think we're seeing it with women's voices. I think we're seeing it in radio. I think that there's a new way in which people are taking back story. So I can see a cracking. And it's not the way, the old way it's done. There's nothing stodgy about some of these new podcasts. Are so exciting.
You know, you suffered through a number of years in which mortgages and health insurance were the main things on your menu.
And I think that that became, I think that's the dreadful prison, real prison of so many, you know, U.S. citizens, is that there's this unconscious, powerful force of a kind of really criminal partnership between special interests, banking, pharmaceutical companies, and the government, that, you know, so many citizens get locked into this idea of quote-unquote the American dream, and then really you get on a treadmill of having to pay off this hideous ceiling of debt. And I don't know how you get away from healthcare costs in this country. There's a fabulous new book out called America's Bitter Pill. I think I've got the name right. And I heard the author being interviewed recently on Fresh Air. And it really makes you realize that part of the problem with the way that, you know, I think the commodification of everything is we're not as well informed as we once were. We're getting our information from narrower and narrower places. We're not reading deeply. We're not paying attention to those sorts of things. And yeah, then I think you can become enslaved by the sort of treadmill of mortgages and health insurance.
You know, your mother lost her mind more than once. And in her thinking, maybe it's better to be slightly crazy than to be bored. Do you go along with her thinking in that way?
You know, her real deep, sad, lonely mental illness is something I wouldn't wish on anyone. It looks awful. And really what it made me realize is that I value my voice as a freedom above, I think, almost anything, but that you can't know what it is you want to say unless you're first in possession of your mind. And to be in possession of your mind as a woman, I think, means to really take the narrative back from thousands of years of a male narrative and say, this is how it is for me as a woman in this time now.
You know, one thing that happened a few years ago, they discovered the feminist Chinese woman's language that had been kept on for thousands of years and men had no idea it existed.
And, you know, I think that in a lot of indigenous cultures and in a lot of indigenous cultures, you know, in Africa and certainly here, that's true. That remained true. But if you look around at the way power structures have sort of formed here, it's very much masculine, and they've taken over the narrative. And what tends to happen to women is they take on a male or a masculine narrative in order to compete. And the one thing that's so striking to me, having sort of lived it and come out the other end, not depleted. I mean, I think a lot of women do come out the other end so exhausted they, you know, are sort of unable to be in possession of their mind and speech. But when men sort of said, yes, women can have it all, what they meant, well, that was really code for women should just do it all.
On an earlier book tour, you were asked in a Q&A whether you consider yourself to be African. And I'd like to read your what you wrote out as your response.
I thought about explaining that technically speaking, in terms of passports and birthrights, I had only ever been African in the loosest sense of the word, and even then for only a fraction of my life. For a few years in the 1970s, we had become Rhodesians, but the Rhodesia of those days was a pariah nation, an illegal republic unrecognized by the rest of the world. The Rhodesia of my blue passport, embossed with two rampant sable antelope, was a country at war with itself, out of step with social progress, and at vehement odds with prevailing global attitudes towards civil rights, racial equality, and black African independence. And when my family could have become legitimate Africans at the transition from Rhodesia to Zimbabwe in 1980, my parents relinquished our claim to Zimbabwean passports and opted to revert British. Thereafter, we continued to live in Southern Africa as expatriates. Poms, we were scornfully dubbed, as in prisoners of Mother England, or Soetpiel, as in one foot in Britain, one foot in Southern Africa, and a salty penis in the sea between. And by the time Mum and Dad embraced the obvious fact that they could never be anything but Zambian, it turned out to be easier said than done. It took scores of visits to the immigration office, mountains of paperwork, and years of waiting for the correct authority to recover from malaria or to return from a funeral and then to find the correct rubber stamp for Mum and Dad to be granted permanent residency in Zambia. But by that time, I had long since married Charlie, moved to Wyoming, and sworn allegiance to the Stars and Stripes. The fact that I felt more at home in Southern Africa than I did anywhere else on Earth, and that I missed the countries of my youth with a physical ache, didn't make me a legitimate citizen of Zimbabwe or Zambia any more than an amputee's cruel sensation of a missing limb renders them whole again. Did I consider myself African? The truth is, I longed to say yes, as I had years ago, even defensively, of course, yes. I longed to have an identity so solid, so obvious, and so unassailable that I, or anyone else, could dig all the way back into it for generations and generations and find nothing but more and further proof of the bedrock of my Africanness. I wanted to be like my fellow speaker. No one would have asked her if she considered herself African because she looked and sounded exactly as anyone might imagine an African should. Although maybe if challenged, she would have rejected the label of African and instead insisted on her identity as Nigerian, or more specifically as Igbo, or less particularly as a citizen of the whole world, or more broadly as a feminist. Perhaps she would have said she was none of the above, but we would never know, because she wasn't the one whose identity was in question. I said, not anymore. Not especially. After the reading, I found my way up to the rooftop of my hotel and lay shoeless on a sun lounger until midnight. High, thin clouds were misted pink with city lights. Behind them, the stars were muted in a moonless sky. The moon, waning crescent, would be rising late. I knew without being able to see them that a few thousand feet up, there would be star-reading birds migrating north out of this heat toward our unrolling Wyoming mountain summer. Owls, thrushes, orioles, sparrows. I knew that for some birds, migration is almost all they do, non-stop, hundreds of miles north, hundreds of miles south, back and forth, a ceaseless rustle of wings, years shaved off their wild lives with all the effort of near-perpetual motion. Once, 25 years ago, camping near a waterfall on the Zambian border with Zaire, I'd caught a glimpse of a distant flock of birds travelling at night against a full moon, fleeting black cut-out shapes intent on destination. Often since then, I've searched the night sky, and although I have caught the brief twists of bats flitting through currents of insects, I have never again seen that nighttime miracle of birds secretly stitching together south and north with their hunger, with their collective, insistent, mounting realization of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I am African, I said aloud to myself now. It sounded ridiculous. To be honest, I thought it sounded faintly ridiculous even when Tabo and Becky had said it. Like P.G. Woodhouse's Bertie Wooster assessing Shakespeare. Sounds well, but doesn't mean anything. I knew I would never apply the label of African to myself again, and not only because it wasn't strictly correct, how can a person belong to a whole continent, but also because it was something I would be called upon to defend endlessly. So as long as the question continued to be asked, I would likely continue to respond as I had tonight. Not anymore. Not especially. And in any case, what life had taught me is that where we come from is a point, not the starting point, not the defining point, just a point. It's where we are that really counts.
Thanks for reading that.
Thank you.
That was Alexandra Fuller reading from her new memoir, Leaving Before the Rains Come. When you married Charlie Ross at 23, were you looking for him to provide some more defined parameters for your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was. This is the tricky thing about memoir, is that you know, if you're looking back, you know, at this point, sort of 23 years, 24 years, it's. I think that you tend to sort of put narrative on what was instinct and what was reaction. But if I look back with a sort of older woman's clarity to my younger self, I was exhausted by then. And I think what Charlie represented was adventure with the possibility of rescue, as opposed to misadventure without any possibility whatsoever that anyone was going to be sensible enough to rescue us. So it was as if he was this kind of perfect partner for me. I had been raised to believe that being boring was the deadliest sin possible. And he lived a life of adventure. He was, he was a river guide and had traveled the world. And yet he had this language that led me to believe that he understood something about assurances that the rest of us had missed, about insurance, about mortgages, about, healthcare, about the U.S. government, and democracy, and freedom of speech, and all those things that just simply weren't available. Credit, none of that's available in Zambia. The fact that that turned out to be a fragile veneer that swamped so many millions of people in 2008 didn't really occur to me, because that was a completely foreign language to me. It was as if he understood the world, and does in fact understand the world, completely differently than I do. From a Southern African point of view, it was ridiculous that you could borrow so much money, that money could be quote-unquote cheap, that you could, have such a thing as a mortgage. Things in Zambia were very much more earthy. If you couldn't afford it in cash at that moment, you couldn't have it. It was that simple. So we're a much less spoiled people. But in that way, in spite of all our seeming chaos, far more certain of where the ground is.
Now, you have three children. Your eldest is 21, I suppose. We don't hear much about them. How are they doing?
They're well. And I think that's an interesting point and an important one. I think one of the things a memoirist has to do is make a choice about what she's going to expose privately, what's going to remain private, what is personal, what can be public. For me, the line, I don't really have the enzyme that has a private life. I really apparently don't care who knows what about me. But I understand that that's not true for everyone. And instinctively, as a mother, I keep the children well out of this memoir. I mean, the fact of their birth exists. And the miracle, really, that sort of crashing love they have exists, because that changed everything. And I think that was an important thing to put into the book, because one of the things that is very true of being a woman is your biology absolutely dictates so much of your history. You can't walk away from pregnancy the same way that a man can walk away from an ejaculation. There is a biological event that happens to you that changes everything from thenceforth. However wonderful and miraculous that is, and for so many women, of course, it's not a choice. So the children exist in the book, in as much as my life was affected by having them. But even that is pretty closed off with a sort of tourniquet of protection. Because I feel as if they're the privilege of the intimacy that I've shared with them and with their father, that's not up for grabs in terms of my writing about it.
There's a line in Galway Canal, what can abide the fire must be made to go through the fire. Do you think your life has in any way been like that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't feel scorched by it. In fact, I feel increasingly, I think even in the happening of what has felt like, you know, catastrophic events and tragedy, I carry with me a very Southern African sensibility of perspective. So my internal self is remarkably calm most of the time. Not to say my system isn't traumatized and I don't understand trauma, I do. But it sort of takes a lot to rattle me. And so no, it hasn't felt like an inferno. Bits of it have, but you know, you come through.
Well, I think that's the point.
Yeah.
You're made to go through so that you can acquire the knowledge that comes with it.
Oh, yes, I see what you mean. Oh, gosh, well, could there be a gentrifier?
I really like your father. He seems to me somewhat a fatalist, but very much a realist.
He reminds me of a brandy-drinking, pipe-smoking Buddhist monk.
I think I like that, yeah. What comprises your community at this point? Who and what?
Oh, that's a good question. It's my community's shrinking, as maybe it must as we get older. I think that, you know, perhaps like writing, as each book, you know, makes you get older and sharper. And you know, I think that's true of my relationships. You know, so my children, certainly, my lover, and really a handful of friends.
There's a line you quote, I believe it was James Sickens. I'm not sure about the name, but it's, everyone needs a place that shouldn't be inside anyone else.
I absolutely love that.
That's a great line.
Yes, and I think that that's a difficult thing. I think that we misunderstand love so much. We mistake dependency for love or duty for love or a whole bunch of other things as love. And yes, there are, I think, elemental differences in love. You know, there is romantic love and there's sort of passionate love. But that really deep abiding love really has to begin profoundly within you and be contained. You can't sort of, you know, lurch out of your own body into the stepping stone of somebody else's security. Or that becomes a vessel that won't float.
For Between the Covers, this is Jim Schumach. My guest today, memoirist Alexandra Fuller. Her most recent memoir, Leaving Before the Rains Come, has just been published by Penguin Press. Always wonderful to have you drop in. Thanks so very much, Alexandra.
Thank you for having me again. I love our talks.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lowellhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps, located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
welcome to the film show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and I'll be joined later in the show by my co-host, Jen Chavez. We have a slate of filmmakers and story midwives for you today. Our theme is down-to-earth documentaries, and we'll be joined on the phone by documentarian Todd Darling. He has a new documentary out. He's returning to KBOO with Occupy the Farm. It's been getting rave reviews. But first, we have on the line, we have Jen in the studio with story midwife Laura Loforti. She directs the NPMTC Vanport Multimedia Project and will be part of the Northwest Film Center's evening with community-based storytellers. Let's hear from Jen and Laura Loforti.
In less than 4 months in 1942, in the land between Portland and the Columbia River, the city of Vanport was hastily built to temporarily house an influx of wartime shipyard workers. Many of them were African Americans who were largely shut out of Portland by racist housing policies. It was the second largest city in Oregon and the largest federal public housing project in the nation, built on vulnerable reclaimed lowlands. And on a single afternoon in 1948, a flood and the breach of a dike put the whole city underwater, killing 15 people and displacing tens of thousands. A recent